Welcome to session three of the Yoga Sutra book study group. Tonight's session is five principles for self-mastery. And it picks up exactly where we left off last session. We talked a lot about abhyasa and vairagya as these twin, mutually intertwined principles, practices that really are the very life force of yoga itself. They embody the spirit of yoga. And it's not a particular practice, but rather the very spirit that carries all yoga practice forward, brings yoga to life, is abhyasa and vairagya. And of course, this is in context to abhyasa and vairagya being the pathway that leads us to samadhi. That's exactly where it began, that through abhyasa and vairagya, we can attain mastery over the roaming tendencies of the mind, mastery over the vrittis of the mind. And then we discussed what abhyasa and vairagya really mean in quite detail. And we saw that abhyasa is all about maintaining a peaceful flow of awareness. Very simple idea, but very rich. And all of yoga really aims at helping us do so. Understanding ourselves on deeper and deeper levels so that we can experience this peaceful flow of awareness in a way which is more and more real, more and more rich. And in the context to most of our practice, it's really looking at that peaceful inward flow of awareness and how we can discover our hidden depths, our deepest potential. And complementing abhyasa is vairagya, normally translated as non-attachment, but really we looked at it from the perspective of refining our self-identity, how we need to continue to see ourselves in a new light and see which aspects of ourself are limiting, binding, painful, and transform them or transcend them so that we can more genuinely, more richly experience this peaceful flow of awareness. That's the whole point of this vairagya, of this refining our self-identity. It's not about whether it being good or bad. It's purely in context to whether or not there are certain aspects of ourself which prevent us from discovering and maintaining this peaceful flow of awareness. So they're really completely intertwined. And ultimately, that this peaceful flow of awareness becomes a dominant thread of our self-identity, if not the fundamental basis of our identity. And that everything in us, all of our habits, all of those threads of the fabric of our personality, become fully aligned with this goal of abhyasa, which is to experience a peaceful flow of awareness. That becomes our very intrinsic self-identity. And ultimately, this process of vairagya matures into a state of realization, an experiential state of vairagya, where we're fully held by this completely mature state of awareness, peaceful flow of awareness, where our abhyasa is so mature that we are able to completely dissolve ourselves into that. And the question really is it our effort which allows us to be completely established in our abhyasa, in our peaceful state of awareness, or is there something more? And the last sutra that we ended with says that vairagya, that reaching samadhi, reaching that experience of our essential self nature, we reach the final step through our abhyasa, but that last step towards samadhi is something more than just our practice. It's the culmination of our vairagya, where we learn to trustfully surrender ourselves to that experience, to dissolve ourselves into that experience and go beyond. It's acknowledging that our self-effort can take us 99.99% of the way there, but that last step to reaching infinity, that state of perfection, completion, is always something that comes from a higher source. That's why we know it's perfect, because we know that it's that gift that we are prepared to receive and assimilate now. That's called samadhi. And that's exactly where 117 picks up, where we begin today. In these two sutras of 117 and 118, Patanjali defines samadhi. And we'll talk about these two somewhat briefly, and we'll return to this whole concept of samadhi in much more detail in sessions 7 and 8, when there's a longer and more technical discussion of samadhi. But really, in this context, I think it's useful to look at these two sutras, 117 and 118, directly in context to what we studied last time, on how abhyasa and vairagya lead us to different experiences of samadhi. So the first thing which is really intriguing to look at in this definition of samadhi is that it's not an all or nothing deal. It's much more nuanced than this, which is very important to recognize. Samadhi is usually described as something which is unattainable. That's kind of how we see it, that it must be that pinnacle of practice because we can't reach there. Something absolutely amazing, indescribable, beyond comprehension, and probably beyond my capacity. That's why it must be so good, because I can't have it right now. What Patanjali is saying is that all of us are capable of experiencing samadhi here and now, but the experience of samadhi is directly in proportion to our capacity of abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa and vairagya are the gateway to samadhi. That's exactly what the sutra told us last time. Our engagement with this abhyasa and vairagya has a direct correlation to the type of experience of samadhi which we gain. Samadhi we can first define as an experience of our essential self nature. And the more we know about ourselves, the richer this experience is, the more essential this essential self nature is. There's a series of stages. 117 talks about samadhi from the perspective of samadhi being a process, being an unfoldment of our capacity. And it goes into some very specific technical definition. So now we can get a little bit more precise. It takes us back to abhyasa. The technical definition of abhyasa is maintaining a peaceful flow of awareness. And what's implicit in this is that it's maintaining a peaceful flow of awareness by virtue of finding a stable object for our mind to rest in or focus itself on. Something, we define it to be a peaceful flow of awareness because there's definition given to how our mind is engaged. Normally, when the mind is flowing in the world, it's so there's so much richness of experience and there's so much diversity of experience that the mind bounces from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, almost at light speed. It's exhausting in many ways. It's very thrilling, very exciting, and yet it's also very tiring because the mind doesn't have any sustenance and it's continually moving, 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 moving. This is exactly what we talked about in early sessions about vrittis, this ever-flowing, ever-externally flowing tendency of the mind where it's always seeking the next. Before we've even had a chance to enjoy where we're at, we're on to the next thing, which very much sums up the nature of modern life as well, that there's not much time given to actually being present and enjoying our accomplishments because there's so much energy that's spent invested in worrying about what comes next or the fear about losing whatever we have today. This is nothing new. It seems like it's a 21st century problem and it's all technology and all whatever we've created for ourselves. And in part, I think some of our stress is self-created. But there's a deeper reality here that unless we can train the mind will naturally gravitate towards flowing outward and not having a very stable flow of awareness. So what we're doing here is trying to train the mind to be content and flow in a very purposeful manner with a particular anchor for that awareness, a focal point. to use the language of yoga, focal point. And we train the mind to flow through that focal point and be disciplined, that very first sutra of yoga, Atha Yoga Anushasanam, be disciplined to maintain its awareness in that object, or of that object, on that object. That's what abhyasa in a technical or literal sense is talking about. Training the mind to rest comfortably while focusing on a particular object of our focus. Samadhi has a lot to do with the type of object that we select for our focal point. Wherever the mind is resting, whatever is that pathway through which we cultivate this peaceful flow of awareness has a lot to do with what we experience. And that's exactly what this sutra is talking about here. Patanjali categorizes the process-driven aspect of samadhi, which is also termed as lower samadhi, and we'll talk about why it's lower, as having four different stages. And each of these stages has to do with the type of object that the mind is focused on. The other thing that's very important to keep in mind here is that in this lower state of samadhi, which is termed as sampragyata samadhi, there's a very clear distinction between ourself as the meditator, or ourself as a distinct individual, the object that we're focusing on, and the process of that focus. So put another way, ourself as the meditator, the object of our meditation, and the process, the experience of meditation. There's a very clear subject-object relationship. So even though it's peaceful, there's still not oneness in these three streams of awareness. They're three highly disciplined, highly stable threads in this flow of awareness. Ourself as the meditator, whatever we're meditating on, and the actual process of meditation. And because there's this threefold awareness, it's not considered complete oneness. We're not completely dissolved into that. And all of these aren't completely dissolved into each other. That's, again, one of the very technical definitions behind this lower samadhi. This is still far, far, far more stable and more peaceful than the normal state of mind, these vrittis, where we're constantly flowing outward, often without even knowing why we're engaged. There's a very, very clear sense of purpose in these stages of samadhi. We've consciously understood ourselves to be a practitioner, a meditator, seeking that focal point of awareness. We've mindfully chosen a focal point of awareness, and we're engaged in the process of that meditation, of that concentration of our awareness to flow peacefully. So it's very intentional, very different than most of the time of how the mind is engaged. And yet, it's still not complete oneness. That's why it's called lower samadhi. It's a process. We'll talk more about these four different states of samadhi when we get into the later sutras, but it's worth mentioning a little bit about them now just so we have some context. The first state of samadhi is one where our object of meditation is something more tangible. Let's call it a discernible object, tangible object, or a very concrete thought. Something that we can give words to. And this is where a practical example is something that we can see, smell, taste, touch, or hear. Sometimes the object of our meditation has a direct counterpart in the external world. It's a particular image. It's a particular object, potentially, that we find very comforting, very soothing, that allows our mind to be focused on that comfortably and rest there. The next stage of samadhi is one where we're focusing on a feeling or a subtle object, something which is no longer as defined by an external characteristic, but is more of a feeling, but a feeling that still has its roots or its definition in something that we can pinpoint, but getting a little bit more subtle. The next stage after this is a focal point of awareness that has joy as its most predominant characteristic. Much, much more subtle. In fact, you might say, how is joy different than a feeling? It's not being happy about a particular thing or feeling joy, but it's a pure experience of joy itself. Again, it's harder and harder to describe all these things because they're becoming more and more subtle, which is why very little emphasis is put on all this definition, which almost might seem like splitting hairs, and much more on abhyasa and vairagya to reach here. In that this transition from a samadhi that is a process of our focus, our meditation on an external object to a subtle object or a feeling to joy is something that will happen naturally as we continue to progress. The fourth stage, the highest stage of what we'll call lower samadhi, the process-driven samadhi, is where our focal point is a pure sense of self-awareness itself. It's not any specific thing, but a pure awareness of ourself as a discrete individual being, our own self-identity. That might remind you a lot about the higher, the further stages of vairagya as a process, where we're refining our self-identity, and it's less and less defined by our samskaras, our past subtle impressions in our mind, and more an awareness of ourself as a being, a discrete individual being. Our identity is less defined by anything outside of us, and it's exactly whatever we are within. That's a direct correlation to this fourth state of lower samadhi, samadhi where it's still a process. These are the four stages of samadhi that directly correspond to four milestones in our abhyasa and vairagya. That might be another way of looking at it, that these are milestones. The goal here is to work with abhyasa and vairagya, and it's not that we go from 0 to 100 all at once. We keep experiencing a richer and richer capacity for this peaceful flow of awareness, a more and more refined self-identity where we upgrade those identities which were once limiting, binding, or painful with identities which are more and more freeing, which are more and more in alignment with this peaceful flow of awareness. And there are certain milestones in our journey that we're able to grow more and more subtle and inward, that initial focal point that was a gross object or a very specific concrete thought is replaced by something more subtle and more subtle and more subtle. Why is that useful? The goal of samadhi is to find our essential self-nature. We have to grow more and more expansive. That was one of those discussion points from two sessions ago, to grow, that we're seeking to grow more subtle, more potent, and more expansive. That's what this more and more subtle, more and more potent, and more expansive object of our awareness gives us. It's an intriguing question to ask, are we growing and therefore the object of our meditation is growing? Or is it the other way around, that the object of our meditation is growing more subtle, more potent, and more expansive, and therefore we grow? And the truth is, it's both together. That directly in proportion to our subtlety, our expansiveness, our discovery of our own inner power, we're able to find resonance in a particular object for our focus. And choosing an object wisely, where it helps us to take that next leap and gently but meaningfully expands our capacity, is equally important. It's this amazing relationship between ourself as the meditator, the object of our meditation, and our process of meditation, which you might call our abhyasa and vairagya. That amazing alchemy of these three is what's mapped out in these four stages of samadhi that are described in 117. So it really shouldn't be something which is so esoteric and scary that we think that samadhi is something to be filed away for a long, long time away in the future. It's about helping us see how we can define milestones in our inner evolution and set goals for ourselves and help us to know how we can make sure we have the right tools to reach the right goals. Asking ourselves to reach a goal without knowing how to do so is very, very frustrating. It's a recipe for disaster and disappointment. So that's where each of these stages of samadhi are correlated to a different type of object of our meditation. It's not that anyone is better or worse. They're simply more appropriate at a certain stage in our growth. We begin with something very concrete. We might begin with our process of meditation by literally visualizing something that we see in the external world, a very tangible object. And from there, it'll grow more and more subtle until at some point, it's so subtle that it's hard to describe with words. It's a pure feeling. Samadhi. So hopefully this demystified samadhi a little bit and helped us to see that the best way to begin working with samadhi is by looking at abhyasa and vairagya and seeing how we can grow on this path. The segue to 118, which is talking about higher samadhi, is exactly where the discussion or study of abhyasa and vairagya took us last week. We saw that there is a process of abhyasa. We grow more and more and more subtle in this and refined in our inward flow of awareness. We grow more and more refined in our self-identity. But at some point, it's not our effort which is the deciding factor. We realize that there's something much richer, much bigger, much more real that underpins all of our abhyasa and vairagya. That's the capacity which allows us to begin being open to the idea of trustful surrender. Any discussion of trustful surrender before we have completely reached the furthest extent of our own human self-effort intrinsically feels like surrender. Feels like we're giving up. Feels like we didn't do everything that we should. So the word surrender itself is perhaps not the right word in here. What we're talking about is completion. We've all experienced this in our own life. When we're really proud of the fact that we've done everything that we should. And an amazing byproduct of that is that we're quite content with wherever we reach, even if the world labels that particular achievement as almost there but not good enough. That just completely falls to the wayside. No one else is going to tell me anymore whether it's almost good or not good enough. I know that I've done everything which I'm supposed to in this particular role, in this particular duty, in my dharma, in my abhyasa and my vairagya. Everything which is meant to be expressed through these two very rich words has been fulfilled. Now I am willing to be embraced by something much bigger and surrender myself, offer myself to that willingly, happily. It's not our effort which brings us to infinity. It's our willingness to allow that infinite to embrace us. That's exactly what Sutra 118 is talking about in the word asamprangyata samadhi. That it's no longer a process of samadhi. It's no longer our self-effort-driven abhyasa and vairagya, but rather a completely experiential state of realization that's called higher samadhi, where we achieve oneness with our essential self-nature. Rather, that essential self-nature is fully blossomed and we dissolve ourselves into that. There's no longer a sense that there's a little bit more to do. And it's no longer my abhyasa and my vairagya, but rather it is exactly whatever I am is what I experience myself to be. It sounds a lot like more philosophical jargon until we have a meaningful relationship with it, until we encounter a point in our life that gives us some reference. And all of us, if we search hard enough, can find those reference points of when we know that we've exhausted human effort not through lack of effort, carelessness, negligence, but rather because of a purposeful, masterful engagement. In this case of yoga, a very, very purposeful, masterful engagement in our abhyasa and vairagya, and we're ready for more. And it's a mysterious thing, and that's probably why the word samadhi is almost exclusively used in that mystical way, that is something beyond comprehension. And I think the beauty of yoga is that it's telling us that we don't need to take it on faith, so to speak. It's a matter of experience. I said that this asampragyata samadhi is an experiential state. It's definitely not an intellectual state. And it's not a process. It's an outcome. It's rather, actually, that might not be the best word. It's no longer this threefold process or this process where there's three distinct streams of awareness of ourself as the meditator, the object of meditation, and the process of meditation. All those three fully intersect. It's effortless. There's a tremendous degree of effortlessness in this. If we talk a lot about how yoga has to do with stability and comfort, an effortless effort. Those are literal definitions of asana, for instance, that we'll talk about much later. Those three words have a lot of meaning here when we're looking at samadhi. That the stability of our experience, the comfort of our experience, allow it to mature slowly over time to a state of realization which is completely effortless. We're held by that state of experience. We're no longer working hard to maintain it. That's exactly what asampragyata samadhi, higher samadhi, is all about. It's the maturity of our abhyasa and vairagya, where we're fully absorbed in our self nature. We'll come back to samadhi. There's more to say. Only two sutras are given for this technical definition of samadhi before we move on. And it's amazing to see what the next sutra is telling us. Next sutra, in my view, basically is helping us to understand why does it appear that samadhi is a little bit easier for some people to experience and a little bit harder for others. And more, that might be one way of looking at the question. The other question, a way of looking at it, which is slightly more empowerment-oriented, is how can I reach there myself? Rather than feeling as concerned about why someone else got there, quote-unquote, first, how can I reach there whenever it's the best thing for me? Not too early, not too late, exactly on time. And there's a really amazing discussion just packed into one sutra. This is 119. That talks about two broad categories of yogis. It's not meant to be divisive and split everyone into two groups, the good yogis and the not as good yogis. It's to help us see how we can reach there ourselves. One category of yogis are upaya pratyaya yogis, yogis who are engaged in practice. The literal meaning of the word upaya means means. So a better translation, in fact, is yogis who should give tremendous significance to selecting the right means, upaya, to reach samadhi. And what are those means? Abhyasa and vairagya. Yogis who should do their best to keep abhyasa and vairagya as a center point of their life, of their sadhana, their spiritual life, so that that abhyasa and vairagya can allow them to reach their goal of samadhi. Essentially, it's for yogis who are still trying to build momentum in the flywheel of their life. You know, this is really no different than the example of gaining proficiency in a worldly skill. When we're still practicing, we need to really work hard at something. And we need to make sure that the discipline behind the practice is fully at the forefront of our mind. And once there's enough momentum, once we develop that skill and that becomes part of our identity, and it's almost intrinsically carrying us forward. You don't have to spend as much time worrying about the technique. You can spend more time in that flow of experience. So take any type of human achievement, whether it's something in the arts, athletics, even professional skills. A lot of time, many, many years, some cases decades, go into doing the same thing again and again and again and again until we have that muscle memory or that brain memory or that complete confidence in our capacity to do such and such, whatever that is, where we're not really thinking about it anymore. We're allowing that capacity to pull us forward and enjoying the ride that we go on with it. Upaya Pratyaya Yogis are ones where we need to cultivate more proficiency and more comfort level with Abhyasa and Vairagya. And for the sake of our own growth, probably best that we all assume that we're Upaya Pratyaya Yogis. And see those four milestones in our samadhi, see how far we might feel like we've reached. And if we're somewhere within those four, Upaya Pratyaya is perfect for us. Which basically means it's perfect for everyone. And it's an amazing thing. Basically, it means that practice makes perfect, and there's no end to practice. Once we learn to love practice, our journey becomes a lot quicker. And it brings us right back to the idea of more emphasis on understanding and meaningfully engaging with Abhyasa and Vairagya. The second category of yogis that's described here is Bhava Pratyaya Yogis. Yogis who already have built up a significant amount of momentum in their life of Abhyasa and Vairagya. I should also mention that this Sutra 119, the other thing that it's really helping us to see is that there's a bigger picture here about how we grow on the path of yoga. A bigger picture beyond what we've understood in terms of seeing the role of Abhyasa and Vairagya here and now. It really introduces the idea of karma. It's another way of putting it. That if we're saying that samadhi is only to do with whatever amount of Abhyasa and Vairagya, whatever amount of yoga that I've done the last 5, 10, 20, maybe 37 years in my case, that is in some ways very easy, but in another way, it's easy to say, okay, I've done such and such, and I feel pretty good about it. I feel like it's taken me this far. But it also completely is unfulfilling in the sense that, is this all? Is it only whatever I've done now, or is there something more which supports me? Especially in the first question about why is it a little bit faster or not as, for some and not as fast for others? That is a very important question, and we want to know how we can put ourselves on the same pathway. Knowing that it's not a one-shot deal, that whatever you can pack into this 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years, try to get to the finish line before time is up kind of attitude, is a big part of yoga. That there's no such thing as that rigidly defined finish line. And the stress that we put on ourselves from that kind of mindset, a very modern materialistic mindset, leads us to make foolish, short-sighted decisions, where we probably harm our practice of Abhyasa and even more likely Vairagya because we've put an artificial limit on how much we need to do right now. So number one, this, and there's a huge amount, of course, we're leaping right into a big idea like karma, which we'll get to in more detail in the second book, Sadhanapada. But this all of Yoga Sutra, and certainly this 119, it makes a very clear assumption that our life is much bigger than the span that rests between birth and death. There's more than this. And that we arrive with certain capacities and resources. And that whatever capacities and resources we develop now in this life will empower us in whatever is to come. Our practice is never lost. The fruits of our practice are never lost. Therefore, do whatever we can now, but make sure that we're doing it in a very mindful, sustainable manner, rather than trying to go beyond our capacity in a way which might take us a couple steps forward, but then we fall many, many steps backward. Bhavapratya yogis are yogis who gained some high degree of proficiency in abhyasa and vairagya in a previous life and come with that karmic momentum now. It allows them to have a greater proficiency, greater familiarity with this peaceful flow of awareness, this kind of mind which is more naturally inclined and capable of finding its inner essence and refining its self-identity, which allows everything to move a little bit faster. And the one or two amazing comments are made here, because there's some further subdivisions of these bhavapratya yogis, these uniquely gifted yogis, that talk about how what type of identity they cultivated for themselves in lives that came before. And they're divided into two categories based on the kind of identity they established at the time of death, which is even more intriguing. That one category of these bhavapratya yogis, called prakriti laya yogis, had risen above their body consciousness and seen, experienced their identity to be pure light, pure luminosity, and found themselves in that state of awareness at the time of death and were dissolved into primordial nature, into whatever is our source, and then reemerged from there. It's a very distinct way of leaving this world and returning to this world. Because of that, because the identity was so highly refined and had this luminosity as its anchor point, it afforded unique means, unique upaya upon returning, which made the journey a little bit faster. That luminosity is directly connected to the third stage of samadhi that we just talked about, where samadhi in a state of pure joy. The other category of these bhavapratya yogis are yogis who left this world with an identity that was fully absorbed in pure awareness, pure self-awareness. That directly corresponds to that fourth stage of samadhi, a complete oneness where the object of our the object of our focus, of our samadhi, was pure self-awareness. That's how they left the world, and that's how they come back. So it's not that they hit the karmic jackpot. It wasn't a lottery. It wasn't accidental. The samadhi which was achieved before has a very powerful effect on who we become. It becomes a gift. Another way to look at it, this, which makes very much sense in the way that we've defined our entire world today. We work so hard to acquire wealth. Wealth creation is one of those fundamental ideas in the West, the foundation of capitalism, that all citizens of a nation are afforded the opportunity to excel and to achieve wealth creation. It's an amazing idea, because we all know that external wealth cannot go with us wherever it is that we go. Or if we don't go anywhere, then it doesn't go anywhere anyway. So depending on whatever viewpoint you subscribe to. What we're talking about here is a different kind of wealth. A wealth that does have the capacity to go with us and return with us. It's our mind. So cultivating a mind that is so rich that it affords us tremendous resources to continue growing whenever and wherever we return. Again, really big ideas, foundational ideas in the path of yoga, but they give a lot more specificity to this kind of nebulous and mysterious idea of samadhi. That we're simply trying to acquire a unique form of wealth, our mind, highly refined, beautiful state of mind. And that travels with us. Even if we somehow say that, well, I'm not sure if I can achieve samadhi this lifetime, what we can certainly say is whatever we do with ourselves now and whatever type of mind we cultivate will travel with us and becomes the foundation to reach samadhi next time. That's exactly what Sutra 119 is all about. That finding our anchor point, that focal point of awareness of pure joy, of pure self-awareness, is the one of the greatest forms of wealth. And that's what these two types of bhava pratyaya yogis have achieved. And they come with that wealth and they reinvest that to achieve even more richness. Great. We need to reach samadhi so that we can grow and reach even deeper levels of samadhi. I get it. Makes complete sense. I need to work with abhyasa and vairagya. You already told me that in session two. Isn't there something else? That's where 120 picks up. And it introduces these five unique qualities that a yogi must cultivate to achieve self-mastery. And more specifically, five unique qualities that allow us to employ our abhyasa and vairagya so that we can also move towards the caliber of a bhava pratyaya yogi, these yogis that have more innate capacity to reach samadhi and remain in samadhi. Five qualities that really help us unfold our deepest human potential. And before it talks about those five, it introduces the idea of self-reflection. First, we need to reflect on where we've come from and where we wish to go. See life as this ultimate gift because it's the opportunity to dive deep and find all of our hidden resources and unfold them. So this process of vichara, mindful self-reflection, helps us to begin diving deep and making best use of whatever we have. The five qualities that we're talking about here are five qualities that every human being has. Whether you're this upaya pratyaya yogi, a yogi still that's fully engaged in practice, or a bhava pratyaya yogi, a yogi that has a little bit more momentum along the way. Everyone has these five qualities. The more we unfold them, the more we grow as a human being, and the further along the path we find ourselves. The first quality is called Shraddha. Shraddha is almost always literally translated as faith, which is probably the first reason why it just becomes a tough idea to work with. So the first thing you're telling me that the first thing I need to do to be a more complete human being and grow on the path of yoga is have faith. How is that any different than what any other religion tells me? That have faith first and everything else will just take care of itself. Is that what we're talking about here? I thought yoga was about self-effort rather than faith in something else. The amazing thing is that the word faith is probably a poor translation because faith always is faith in such and such. It always goes with that. And what we're talking about here is something quite a bit more subtle and quite a bit more personal in many ways. If we go to the Secret of the Yoga Sutra and we look at page 97, the commentary here tells us something amazing. That a more technical and ancient definition of this word Shraddha is, quote, a completely clear and joyful state of mind. The Sanskrit word for this is samprasada. A completely clear and joyful state of mind. That's an extraordinary way of defining a word that we would have otherwise defined as faith. It tells us a lot about what the intent behind faith is. A mind that's clear and joyful is a mind that is able to either go in or out purposefully. So much of the difficulty on the path of yoga, and really in life, is that we're not clear on where we're headed. And because we're not clear, because we don't know if it's anchored in purpose, our capacity to feel joyful, to derive some sustenance from that, is heavily compromised. And the amazing thing here is that we're not joyful about a particular thing. It's not dependent on a particular achievement, a particular external awareness. This is a state of mind which is independently joyful and clear. It's a highly refined state of mind. Every human being has the potential to achieve this. And this potential doesn't come from how much we acquire or how successful we are outside of ourselves. That success may or may not contribute to this samprasada, this joyful, clear state of mind. It's not to say that the world takes us away from clarity and joy. Many experiences will contribute if we have the right perspective and right relationship. It comes from inside. Our external achievements don't give it to us, but rather we bring that clarity and joy to it. Another amazing statement is made in the commentary here about this first of these five qualities. That love for practice comes from knowing its importance. It must be the center of our lives. It's talking a lot about how this, what we call faith, has a lot more to do with knowledge. Once we know why we're practicing, we're able to cultivate a genuine love for it. We have to understand where it can take us. And it must be the center of our lives. We must be able to find some singular importance in what we're doing. And help allow that to breathe life into our path. It might sound a little bit circular. So that we need to love our practice, we need to do our practice so that we can have something to love. Really what we're talking about here is having the capacity to love our practice. Take that one step further, having the capacity to love life itself. Is this never-ending series of experiences and achievements that we're trying to bundle together and define as a purposeful, successful life? In which case, there's always going to be a little bit missing. There's always one more experience that we wish we could have had, one little bit that will make it enough. So it's not more and more. It's helping us to see how our mind itself is saturated by the capacity to be joyful and the embodiment of clarity. Starting from that perspective right there, that this is who I am. This joyful state of mind, which is completely clear, is who I am. And really owning that. Shraddha. Love and respect springing from a true understanding of our practice is Shraddha. So how do you cultivate Shraddha? Shraddha is the fruit of valuing our practice and recognizing its connection to the purpose of life. It's very simple, but really profound. This faith, if you want to use that word, or joyful, transparent state of mind, comes when we value our practice and see how it's directly related to our purpose of life. We're doing something which takes us towards the fulfillment of our purpose. How do we get this kind of knowledge? Two things are described here. One word is called satsang, and the other word, swadhyaya, words that we might have heard before. Company of the wise, company of ones we love, and those who love us is satsang. Wisdom, if someone is very wise, it's not that helpful to us unless there's a genuine relationship. It's not just someone who's intelligent, but there's a true connection. So this word satsang always has a dimension of community, always has a dimension of spiritual family, is another word, lineage, where there's a human connection that's made, and the best in ourself is shared, and we receive the best from others. Wisdom that is fully guided by love is what satsang is all about. Satsang gives us access to Shraddha. You can also see now why the word faith might be brought in here. Someone that you respect, it's called faith. The question is why? And this is where it's a very different thing from blind faith. We all know if we love someone and if someone loves us. Deep in our heart, we know it. It's not an intellectual kind of thing. That is a very clear indication of whether or not this relationship is grounded in Shraddha, in faith. That kind of relationship can feed our soul and awaken a capacity of our mind for clarity and joy that's far beyond anything else that the world can. The second thing which brings us Shraddha is our own self-reflection, self-study. Again, a much, much deeper type of, the word swadhyaya was something we'll come back to in later sessions, but just keep reflecting on that, that our study, both of any wisdom which is shared with us and wisdom that comes from within, grants us Shraddha, this faith. What's the outcome of having this Shraddha, this completely joyful and transparent state of mind? Virya, usually translated as strength, vitality. And often with the connotation of it being physical. Again, that's probably not what we're looking for here. Physical strength is simply a reflection of something much deeper. And that's what virya is all about. It's this capacity to awaken the innate wisdom of our body first. Yoga has a lot to say about this. In that regard, it is a physical capacity. But this strength is really strength which allows us to put our purpose into action. Something much more than physical strength. A little bit more concrete than this, it's a latent power in our body and specifically our breath and senses. So this point of virya as one of the five qualities that all human beings are born with has to do with unlocking our pranic potential, something that we'll come back to in later sessions, that we have a limitless reservoir of inner power, virya, vitality, strength, capacity. And we're able to tap into that capacity by reaching it first through Shraddha, this joyful, transparent state of mind that we call faith, introduces us to our pool of potential. Through practice, we awaken this pool of potential, this pranic pool of potential. And from that, the third quality arises of smriti, usually translated as retentive power. It's amazing. It's like we have a tremendous amount of wealth and we don't even remember where it is or how to use it. And you know, we're reminded of a particular aspect of it, but then something else more interesting comes along and we forget where that bank account is, and then because we're distracted by something intriguing at the time, and then we wonder, how do we get back there again? So this idea of smriti is much more than the ability to memorize a particular passage or to remember every single phone number that's in, you know, that used to be, you know, in our memory, now it's in our iPhone. It's much more than cognitive capacity. This smriti is the ability, again, to link conscious awareness to a deeper purpose and to fully be aware of our potential and how to unfold it. We're all like small, mini stars, brilliant orbs of almost limitless power, and we don't even know it. That's what's being recognized here. That one of the fundamental things that we need to do is remember who we are. It's much easier to do so once we've begun to tap into our vitality, this virya, and do it in a very systematic way so we can retrace all of our steps and know exactly where to go when we need particular capacities. Smriti, retentive power, where we understand and remember why we began our practice, where we've come from, where we've traveled, and where we wish to go. And this might seem abstract, but even look back at our own lives and take our professions, because so much of our life is defined by what we've studied, the work that we've done, and how we've grown in a career or whatever. It's very hard to remember how we've progressed once we've already done it. But those steps, those milestones are useful to help us know that we've done it. And that if there's a particular aspect of that capacity that we need to go back to at some point for a particular purpose, we need to remember how we reached there. If we don't remember how we gained all of our capacity and why we began in the first place, it's almost as if we never had it. It's quite amazing. Knowledge is only as useful as our capacity to put it into context, to know exactly how to apply it. That's what this smriti is all about. Knowing how we cultivated our abhyasa and vairagya so that we can call it forward at the time of need in the exact way that we want. It really comes in handy. And that makes it very practical too, because you never know what curveballs life throws at us. We need to know exactly how we can recall all of our gifts, how we can go back into our vault and get that aspect of our capacity and bring it forward when we need it. That's exactly what makes us empowered. And that, when we look at this goal of reaching samadhi and remaining in samadhi, the biggest challenge with this samadhi business is that obviously you can't go to a mind which is completely stable all in one shot. There's going to be small deviations along the way. We need to know exactly how we can lovingly bring our mind back to that place where we wish to be and know the right tool to do that. There's a quote that I've written down here from the commentary in Secret of Yoga Sutra, that practice flows effortlessly when we're constantly aware that life has a purpose and that we will find this purpose through practice. So that awareness, that constant awareness of how purpose is pulling us through life is a huge gift of this smriti, this retentive power. Constantly being aware that there's a purpose and that our practice helps both guide us there and that the purpose itself is pulling the practice forward. Simple idea, but it's very easy to forget, especially in times of difficulty or in times of success when something more interesting comes our way. That often is the biggest danger point. It might be success, but from another perspective, it's a little distraction which can turn into a big deviation in life. What does this smriti, this retentive power, give us? It allows us to unfold the unique human capacity of samadhi. This samadhi is not used in the same way as what we just defined in Sutras 117 and 118. It's stability of mind, not in that technical sense that we just talked about, but rather a still and stable mind that's able to remember its purpose and be anchored in that purpose. We talked about constant awareness in that retentive power. It's that stability which allows us to hold our purpose as the focal point and align all of life around that. That has a lot to do with this first one of Shraddha, of joyfulness and transparency. When we find ourselves held in place, we're able to really genuinely be content. A lot of this joyfulness and transparency of mind that Shraddha is all about is supported by this kind of mind, this quality of samadhi, this quality of inner stability. That might be a better way of putting it. All human beings have the potential to find inner stability. And that inner stability definitely is heavily supported by inner strength and retentive power. And of course, the very foundation is this unique capacity to find ourselves joyful and clear in the first place. But it's a feedback cycle as well. That stability definitely feeds back in to joyfulness and transparency. That we're able to know exactly why we're here and be present to it, be content. And that contentment just naturally makes us Teflon coated to a lot of things which might otherwise be take away our joy and cloud our mind and remove its innate transparency. That kind of samadhi is what Patanjali is talking about here. And a beautiful example is given in the commentary about that's really trying to help us see how this stability leads to Expansion. Talks about how this kind of mind is like an ocean that can joyfully contain all the streams which flow into it. So what does this analogy mean in a more practical sense? This kind of mind is able to receive all of the experiences of life. All of them are like streams, which very frequently seem to be like they're flooding over the river banks and we're completely drowning in life. Our mind has the capacity to be like an ocean to contain all of that experience without being overwhelmed or drowned in it. That comes from stability, and that stability is grounded in those previous three unique human qualities. All of this put together leads us to the fifth human quality called pragya, intuitive wisdom. And intuitive wisdom, there's a reason why it's the fifth. It's that pinnacle which allows us to reach that higher state of samadhi. It's a discerning awareness which requires no validation. The biggest challenge in our path is, am I sure about this? Doubt, the doubt factor. And abhyasa and vairagya, in practical sense, often is about gaining more and more confidence in ourself, gaining more and more clarity and confidence about what we're really experiencing. Especially in all times, but certainly now, in that right now, our reality is very well defined by the world outside us. Very, very well defined. And we've created an unimaginable diversity of ways, opportunities to see ourselves outside. So it's very, very difficult to know how to see ourselves inside without the crutch of all of these other new tools and means we have. So it's difficult to know whether or not I am, is my experience of myself within everything it's supposed to be? Is there something more I should be doing? Is there something more I should be experiencing? Pragya is intuitive discernment where we know that this is real without needing any further validation. Is it because we've grown a little bit lazy or sloppy? And that why we're saying, oh, well, yeah, this is it, this is done. Or is it because we truly know? And it's very clear that we know exactly when we're fooling ourselves and when we know when it is real and the truth. That's what this fifth quality is telling us, that every human being has that inner truth barometer to know exactly what is real and what's not real. And even one step more than that, it's our capacity to awaken an inner teacher, an inner source of guidance. There's a lot of discussion about having our practice be our teacher and guide us. And that can be a little bit of a challenging idea, especially in more of a modern scientific peer-reviewed manner, where if the experiment itself is supposed to define truth, then you already said that the experiment is perfect, it compromises the integrity of the whole process. So how can my practice be my teacher? Don't I need some other benchmarks that help define truth, that help define reality? It has to be more than that. It is. But that benchmark for knowing reality is not an external benchmark. That's the only difference. In the modern way of looking at the world, science, so to speak, we've defined external benchmarks and everything is in relation to that. Here, we're saying that there's an intuitive inner capacity, this pragya, this discerning wisdom, which is our inner teacher. And every single human being has this. Upon it being awakened, our practice does become our teacher. Our practice has unique self-revealing capacities. And this is absolutely crucial because it allows us to find a new way to see ourselves. That's really what abhyasa and vairagya is all about. That the experience that comes from technical practice is a validation in and of itself. We feel something. We feel better, clearer, richer, more joyful. But at some point, it's not us defining that I'm feeling such and such and such, but rather I simply know it. That last element of doubt begins to melt away. And remember, all these five qualities were in relation to how we achieve samadhi, right? How we grow from being upaya pratyayogi into a bhava pratyayogi, a yogi who more innately is established in samadhi. That last stage where we are convinced that I am content, complete, and willing to be in this space, this highly stable flow of awareness, comes from pragya. The mind is no longer either distraction or curiosity driven to go outside or doubt driven to go outside. We're able to really be present to the awareness. That's what pragya gives us. These five qualities taken together are considered a foundation to grow on the path of yoga and to grow in our abhyasa and vairagya. Sutras 21 and 22 seem very simple at face value, but are telling us something profound. First, in Sutra 121, it's making what appears to be a somewhat obvious statement that with steadfast engagement, we grow. And it's reminding us that vigilance and consistency are the key. And we have to find a way to be patient without being, without succumbing to inertia. So having the patience to continue practicing without allowing ourselves to lose some of our momentum or lose the intensity of our engagement. While we also, so it's a being relentless without being anxious. Having this relentless optimism, this relentless engagement to continue growing, to continue on the path without being anxious about what comes. It's a balance. So this idea of being steadfast, which is the translation that's used in this commentary, has to do with this. Think about it another way. Is this a fear-driven action? Is it an action because I'm afraid of losing something? Or is it a purpose-driven action, where we're trying to use everything we have as means to grow? Why am I engaged on my path? And being very vigilant about this. 122 talks about three different distinctions. Whose engagement, whose steadfast engagement is mild, intermediate, or intense. Again, that seems like a very simplistic thing. Yes and no. It's reminding us that it's not an on and off state. And at different stages in our life, our intensity of our abhyasa and vairagya changes. And in proportion to that, our experience of our practice changes as well. And we'll close just with one or two thoughts here. That, reading from page 105, the deeper our understanding of the practice, these three degrees of aspiration depend on several factors, the most important of which is knowledge. That might be one of the key takeaways here. That it's not about we're a little bit better or slower or faster, a little bit more engaged or less engaged at different times. It has to do with the depth of our knowledge. The deeper our understanding of the practice, the more grateful we are that we have been guided to do it. Gratitude fills our heart with love and compels us to surrender trustfully to the higher reality, which created the conditions conducive to the practice and endowed us with the tools and means of doing it. So knowledge leads to gratitude. And that knowledge-driven gratitude is what really are these three different stages of aspiration. Mild, intermediate, and advanced makes it seem like, you know, it's good, better, best, or that it's working a little harder, and working really hard. So it's not about how hard we work, but it's about the knowledge that propels our abhyasa and vairagya. And more specifically, this knowledge that's fully grounded in our gratitude. And this a very important point is being made here. Gratitude to what? Gratitude to that reality which created the conditions conducive to practice and which endowed us with the tools and means to do the practice. Our recognition that we've been given tremendous gifts is what allows us to accelerate our progress. That's the knowledge that we're talking about here. In the beginning, the knowledge is more knowledge of Abhyasa and Vairagya itself. What capacities do I have and how do I unfold them? It's more technique oriented. It's expanding those five qualities that we just talked about. But later, it's not knowledge of something, but rather knowledge of what our source is and where we derive our strength from that allows us to accelerate our growth. The tradition calls trustful surrender bhakti. This gratitude-driven knowledge is another word for trustful surrender. Trustful surrender, laden with gratitude, yokes us to our practice. It allows practice to accelerate. It allows these five principles to really blossom. And amazingly, it helps us go right into the next sutra, which is the topic for our next session. That our degree of aspiration depends on our degree of knowledge. But to excel, we need to have a profound understanding of how our sadhana is connected to our purpose of life and how our practice finds its roots in a deeper source. That deeper source is what trustful surrender is all about. Trustful engagement, trustful embrace. That's what the idea of Ishwara is all about. The sutras 123 to 129 that are the subject of our next session, where we can really find how we can breathe more richness into our Abhyasa and Vairagya. So thank you and have a wonderful evening. Our homework for next week is to read the sutras 123 to 129 on Ishwara, our eternal guide. Thank you.